we've undertaken, or that I've undertaken, and that you're undertaking with me for however many Wednesday nights it is, are things that touch upon our conscience. And I've begun with things related, in my mind anyway, I mean, I'm trying to put some structure to this, with things related to our public worship, with the way we do church. And so we took a Wednesday night and we talked about music. And we just looked at some of the things the Bible said. We recognized that there are cultural influences. And I would just point out, folks, that I guess to me, it is very, very important that we understand to some extent where the line is between what the Bible mandates and what we practice as an extension of that. And I would say that because I think the human heart very naturally is prone to Pharisaism, to building some kind of a structure and making that the measurement of righteousness, both my own and someone else's. And Jesus just had absolutely no respect for that whatsoever. And of course, the danger is that, you know, it seems sometimes like I would advocate or others would advocate that the solution to that is to tear down every structure. And I do not believe that that is the objective, the goal, or the right response to that. It is to recognize what God mandates and what we do as an extension of that to the best that we can. So that's my goal there. And the next thing that I wanted to touch on, and what we're just really going to begin this evening then, is how we spend the Lord's Day, the number of services we have and the things we do in that. And of course, before we get to that, then, as I worked through it, was understanding where the Lord's Day fits into the grand scheme of things. And so I had originally intended to try and do it all at once, but I just didn't think it would fit in a way that you and I would both be happy with. So we'll take a couple of weeks on this. So let's pray, and then we'll jump into to the book of Genesis. God, I pray your help upon us, that we would be good, solid, faithful, new covenant people. That we would worship you, first of all, obediently to both the clear command and the precept of Scripture. And then secondly, from the sincerity of our hearts, that our consciences would be good and right before you. And I pray that you would make us wise to that end. And so help us to understand your word. And I ask that in Jesus' name. Amen. So Genesis chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, not that it really means anything, but which really probably would be better off being part of Genesis chapter 1. But thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had made, and he rested on the seventh day from all his works which he had made. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in it he had rested from all his work which God created and made. So the seventh day, the Sabbath, because that's what we were talking about there, has been uniquely blessed since the creation. The seventh day was different from the other 6 days because that was the day in which God rested. And of course, we'll get to this, but there's great significance for us in that rest. It wasn't the rest from being tired. It wasn't even really, in a sense, the rest of being finished, although God was finished. God could have been finished and gone on to other God things that he was doing. God, even then, God didn't stop doing the work of sustaining his creation. And we'll see how this unfolds here in a little bit. So rather than a 6-day week, there is a 7-day week. And the seventh day is not the add-on to the week. The seventh day is really the crowning day of the week. God did not bless the first day or the second day or the third day, but he did bless the seventh day, and he did set that day apart. And I would just point out to you folks that, and I think we probably intrinsically know this, that every major time marker of that kind of magnitude has a scientific correlation, and I mean scientific in that that's the way God arranged the world, that in the course of a year, the earth makes a rotation around the sun, and in the course of a month, the moon makes a rotation around the earth, and in the course of a day, the earth makes one rotation on its axis. But the week, that thing that it governs virtually our entire lives, the weeks on the calendar, there's no scientific significance to that. All of the significance is spiritual. The weeks don't have to repeat. I mean, the year has to repeat. We go around the earth, the sun once, and then it starts all over again. Something has flipped over. But that's not really true of the days. There is, I don't want to say an artificial, but there is a non-scientific basis for that. And that is that this is the decree of God. And all of this, of course, because anytime we have any conversation about anything that we do, we're always putting it in some frame of reference to the law of Moses. That's not a bad thing. The New Testament does that. So let's just make sure that we understand we are a long way away from the law of Moses in the creation. So long before there are all of these prohibitions about what you can and cannot do on the Sabbath, there is a decree of God that the seventh day will be unusual. Turn, if you would, to Exodus chapter 12, and we are still prior to the advent of the law. But the seventh day is designated as a set-apart. That's what the word sanctify means. It is set aside as an unusual day. The Sabbath day enjoyed God's blessing and God's designation as a holy day. Exodus chapter 12, verse number 15, 7 days shall ye eat unleavened bread, even the first day ye shall put away leaven out of your houses. For whosoever eateth unleavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that soul shall be cut off from Israel. And in the first day there shall be an holy convocation, and in the seventh day there shall be an holy convocation to you. No manner of work shall be done in them, save that which every man must eat, that only may be done of you. So even prior to the law, this day is observed as an unusual day. Look, if you would, at Exodus chapter 16. In Exodus chapter 16, God has given to the Jews manna. And I'm just reading selected portions. We're going to actually look at in a couple of weeks on Sunday morning, we're going to look at some more stuff about the manna. Exodus chapter 16, let's just start in verse number 21. And they gathered it every morning, every man according to his eating. And when the sun waxed hot, it melted. And it came to pass that on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers for one man. And all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. And he said unto them, this is that which the Lord has said, tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath unto the Lord. Now, we still don't have the Ten Commandments. We still don't have the law of Moses. But we still have a sanctified day out of the week. This is that which the Lord has said, tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath unto the Lord. Bake that ye will bake today, and seethe that ye will seethe, and that which remaineth over lay up for you to be kept until the morning. And of course, you know that one of the miracles among the many miracles of manna was that if you gathered excess on Monday night, it wouldn't keep till Tuesday morning. But if you gathered excess on Friday night, you had enough to get you all the way through till Sunday morning. So God rotted it overnight 6 days a week, and on the seventh day, he miraculously preserved it. So God instituted it in the creation, and he sanctified it even prior to the law. So when the law was given, it wasn't like God said, I'm giving you something new. You can turn to Exodus chapter 20. The law of Moses, and folks, there's a sense in which this is true about every one of the commandments. The law of Moses simply put into a code what had already been in existence. In other words, to make a point, it wasn't like God was okay with thievery, and then he said to the Jews, now, I got something new to tell you, thou shalt not steal. So it's just the encoding, it's just the legislation, and I don't want to demean the law in any way. The law is just and holy and good, says Paul. But we are just simply encoding for the people of God something that is a reflection of what God has already done. Exodus chapter 20 and verse number 8. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. There is a dignity and even a sanctity to human labor. You have 6 days to get everything done. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou nor thy son nor thy daughter, thy manservant nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gate. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. So there it is. Now we've brought it into the law of Moses. So this day that came about in creation, that was sanctified prior to the law, is now a part of the law. And one of the reasons that it exists, if you would turn to Exodus 31, is that it is a symbol. It is a sign. It is something visible that functions as a reminder. That would be the way I would understand the sign. Right? A lot of times, for instance, people will want to see something to believe it. And of course, we know we live in the age of faith, and blessed are they that believe and have not seen. But God did periodically give things that could be seen that were testaments, and that's where we are here. Exodus chapter 31 and verse number 13. Speak thou also unto the children of Israel, saying, verily my Sabbaths ye shall keep. For it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that ye may know that I am the Lord that doth sanctify you. Right? I set apart a day. Now that day becomes symbolic of the fact that I have set you apart. I have set you apart for me. You're not like everybody else. He will say in the book of Deuteronomy, you only of the nations have I known. You're the only one with whom I have this unusual relationship. I have set you aside to me. And the Sabbath day is a sign of that. And so this is what I want you to do. Okay, so verse 14, ye shall keep the Sabbath, therefore, for it is holy unto you. Everyone that defileth it shall surely be put to death, for whosoever doeth any work therein, that soul shall be cut off from among his people. 6 days may work be done, but in the seventh it is the Sabbath of rest, holy to the Lord. Whosoever doeth any work in the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. I mean, it is a capital crime to violate the Sabbath. It is a sign, if you would jump ahead, not only a few books to Deuteronomy, but 40 years. And in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse number 12, we have again a reminder that this is a sign. Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse number 12. Keep the Sabbath day to sanctify it, as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thine ox, nor thine ass, nor any of thy cattle, nor the stranger that was within thy gates, that thy manservant and thy maidservant may rest as well as thou. And remember that thou wast a servant in the land of Egypt, and that the Lord thy God brought thee out thence through a mighty hand by a stretched out arm. Therefore the Lord thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day. So it's a sign to remind the Jews that they belong to God and that God supernaturally cares for them. It is a sanctified day. What did a Jew do on the Sabbath day? And the answer to that is nothing. It wasn't like he had a busy day of getting up and going to the synagogue and listening to a sermon and teaching a elementary age Sunday school class and going home and having a meal and coming back for an evening service. What he did was nothing. Unless it was a festival season, and then they observed the Sabbath in community, what he did was pretty much nothing. He couldn't travel. He couldn't cook. He couldn't light a fire. He couldn't do any work. He couldn't cut his animals loose to do any work. Now, I don't think, folks, you have to have a very creative mind to get the idea of what that day might be like in the mind of a Jew. There's no television to watch, no radio to hear, certainly no computer to play with. There's no place to go, there's nothing to do, there's nothing to read for much of that time. It is not defensible, but it is easy enough to understand why it didn't take the Jews long to violate the Sabbath. Right? I mean, some of you grew up on farms. We're an agricultural people. So imagine now it's October. And by the way, it's not an accident that God put the bulk of the religious festivals at both planting and harvesting season. And here it is, and the crops are ripening, and the harvest needs to be picked, and it's the Sabbath. And there you sit, and you're going, the crops are rotting on the vine. It takes, folks, a tremendous amount of faith to sit in your tent all day long and do nothing while the harvest needs to be picked. Look, if you would, jump ahead, if you would, to Isaiah chapter 58. Because I hope that I have given you in no way any sense that the Lord was sympathetic to that kind of thinking. That the Lord said, oh, look, I know that this is a burden to you. I know there's work to be done, and I know that you'd like to have more time to do it, and I know that the harvest is a busy time or the planting is a busy time and you really want to be in the fields. And these are agricultural people. We're going to get into that in Sunday school. Here we're going to talk about the tithe, and people will point out, you know, there was no tithing of money. That's primarily because there was no money. Not because God was anti-money or devising a system. These were agricultural people. They traded. They bartered. So God is not sympathetic. In other words, God doesn't say to them, look, I know this is going to be a challenge to you, and I'm really kind of sorry, but I got to do it. Because that wasn't the way that God viewed it. God didn't want the Jew to dread that the Sabbath was coming and nothing could be done. He wanted them to be delighted in it. Remember, God blessed it and sanctified it. It was supposed to be the best day of the week, not the worst. And in fact, fast forward many, many hundreds of years to Isaiah chapter 58. Now we're so far from the creation and so far from Moses, we're about 700 years away from the birth of Christ. And this is what the Lord says in verse number 13. If thou turn away thy foot from the Sabbath, from doing thy pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy of the Lord, honorable, and shalt honor him, not doing thine own ways, nor finding thine own pleasure, nor speaking thine own words, then shalt thou delight thyself in the Lord, and I will cause thee to ride upon the high places of the earth and feed thee with the heritage of Jacob thy father, for the mouth of the Lord hath spoken it. So God had no sympathy for people who viewed the Sabbath day as an obstruction to productivity and an intrusion into their will. God's position was, I'm not the one that has the problem here. You're the one that has the problem here. And if you would, go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 36. The nation frequently, oftentimes, most of the time, habitually, chronically violated the Sabbath. And it was business as usual to everybody but the Lord. Second Chronicles chapter 36. And again, I would just point out to you that if you get confused with all the kings and the names and the back and forth and the nations, and you're just trying to get your mind around what the history of the nation of Israel was, 2 Chronicles 36 is the place to go. Let's jump in verse number 15. And the Lord God of their fathers sent to them by his messengers, rising up betimes and sending, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place, that's the temple. But they mocked the messengers of God and despised his words and misused his prophets until the wrath of the Lord arose against his people till there was no remedy. Therefore he brought upon them the king of the Chaldees, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of the sanctuary, and he had no compassion upon young man or maiden, old man or him that stooped for age. He gave them all into his hand. And all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king, and of his princes, all these he brought to Babylon. And they burnt the house of God, and brake down the wall of Jerusalem, and burnt all the palaces thereof with fire, and destroyed all the goodly vessels thereof. And them that had escaped from the sword carried he away to Babylon, where they were servants to him and his sons until the reign of the king of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths. For as long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. So the 70 years isn't just pulled out of thin air. It is a memento to 490 years of Sabbath violations. So this is, by the way, this is kind of a graphic representation of something Paul talks about in Romans 9, 10, and 11 when he talks about God's wrath, maybe it's Romans 2, where he talks about God's wrath being treasured up, being stored up. He doesn't let it go. He doesn't forget about it. He's not indifferent to it. He just keeps letting the offenses accumulate until he chooses in righteousness to act, and boom, there it is. And that is what has happened here. And with that, let me ask you to turn to Matthew chapter 12. And I'm not going to read it yet, but I'm going to ask you to turn there. So So the Jews were hauled off into captivity for 70 years to recover the Sabbath that they had violated. They are brought back into the land, and the two major characters there are Ezra, well, there are three, but Ezra and Nehemiah are major characters in that, and Zerubbabel is a major player in that, and these are where we get some of the minor prophets. In the book of Nehemiah, we can't go back and visit it, but Nehemiah, of course, worked for the Persian government. And he was granted kind of a leave of absence by the king to go and rebuild the wall. But then he had to go back to work, and he was back in Persia for a lengthy period of time, for a number of years. And when he went back to Jerusalem, one of the first things he has to deal with is the fact that people were buying and selling on the Sabbath day. So after being punished for 70 years in exile because you wouldn't keep the Sabbath day, the people who were dedicated enough to go back to Jerusalem were very quickly in violation of the Sabbath day. And of course, Malachi closes out the Old Testament, and we have 400 years of silence from God. And in that period of time, there arise a body of men who are determined to preserve the sanctity of the nation of Israel and the favor of God. And these are, of course, the Pharisees. And one of their major tasks is to become the guardians of the Sabbath day. And one of the ways that they do that, and this is why we must always be cautious about these things, one of the ways that they preserve the sanctity of the Holy Sabbath is by making it unbearable. And weighing it down with billions upon billions of rules and regulations and possible, you can do this, but you can't do this. You can say this, but you can't say this. You can go up, but only this far, and out, but only this wide. And all of these things that they did. And that is the world into which Jesus is born. Jesus never disrespects the Sabbath. But he fights with the Pharisees about it frequently. Their fight is about the nature of the Sabbath and what its purpose is and what it means. In their determination to not offend God and make everybody else honor God, they become the prime offenders. This is serious business, folks. It is serious business to be a Pharisee. It is serious business to label everything that somebody does that you don't like Phariseeism. The death and resurrection of Christ impacted its observation, but not its significance. In other words, did the Sabbath become less important because Jesus went to a cross? Not at all. Well, what's different then? Well, what's different is the way we observe it and the way we think about it. But it hasn't evaporated into the great wasteland of that no longer matters, the way some people treat it. The word Sabbath is actually used 9 times. In the New Testament book of Acts, but it's always in the book of Acts used as a marker. And here's what I mean by that. And maybe this won't mean the same thing to you, but the best illustration I can give you about the way the Jews thought about the Sabbath is the way a pastor of a New Testament church thinks about Sunday. Pretty much, if I don't know any other date in the calendar, I know the dates of the Sundays. 6, 13, 2027, August. 2/9/16/23/30 September. If I want to know what's going on in September, I relate it to a Sunday because I always think in Sundays. Jews always thought in Sabbath days. That was their point of reference. Everything else related to it. I mean, it's like, and if you're scientific and bent, you're probably much more familiar with the metric system than most of us. You know, when I encounter the metric system, what I am doing is mad frantically converting it to something I can relate to. How fast is the speed limit? 100 kilometers. That's 62.5 miles an hour. So a Jew is always taking everything in the calendar and relating it to a Sabbath. So when you find it used in the book of Acts, it's not a day of worship. It is a reference point. How does this day a week relate to the Sabbath day? It is recognized as the day that the Jews met and Paul went in and preached on the Sabbath day. But that was outreach and evangelistic work. That wasn't worship service. Never in the New Testament is there any reference to having the church meet on the Sabbath. And in fact, and we're going to, I had you turn to Matthew 12, and we're going to come back to that in a minute, so don't lose it. But let me ask you, turn, if you would, to Colossians chapter 2. In fact, not only is the Sabbath day, and by that I mean Saturday, the seventh day of the week, not only is it the day that the church met for worship, it is specifically within the framework of the New Testament designated as something outside of the mandate for New Testament worship. Now, not everybody would agree with me on that, and I've talked to a couple of you privately. If you are a fan of Alistair Begg, and Alistair Begg's a pretty good guy, and he's just a delight to listen to because he's from Scotland and he's been pastoring in the Cleveland area for the last 25 or 30 years. But he would tell you that the Sabbath is binding upon the New Testament. But I'm not really sure what to do with that mentality in light of Colossians chapter 2, beginning in verse number 9. For in him, Christ, dwelleth all the fullness of the Godhead bodily, and ye are complete in him, which is the head of all principality and power, in whom also are ye circumcised with the circumcision made without hands, in putting off of the body of the sins of the flesh by the circumcision of the heart of Christ, buried with him in baptism, wherein also ye are risen with him through the faith of his of the operation of God who hath raised him from the dead. And you being dead in your sins and the uncircumcision of your flesh hath he quickened together with him, having forgiven you all trespasses, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. And having spoiled principalities and powers, he made a show of them, openly triumphing over them in it. Let no man therefore judge you in meat or drink or in respect of an holy day or of the new moon or of the Sabbath, which are a shadow of things to come, but the body is of Christ. So we don't disrespect the Sabbath, but the slavish Jewish observation of the Sabbath is not the way that we honor it, because they were looking at a shadow and we are living in the body. We have what they did not. We observe in a way different than what they do, but we observe the sanctity of the day nevertheless. So with that, let's go back to Matthew chapter 12. Let's start in verse number one. My apologies. At that time, Jesus went on the Sabbath day through the corn, which means grain, and his disciples were anhungered and began to pluck the ears of corn and to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto him, Behold, thy disciples do that which is not lawful to do upon the Sabbath day. But he said unto them, Have ye not read what David did when he was anhungered, and they that were with him, how he entered into the house of God and did eat the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, neither for them which were with him, but only for the priests? Or have ye not read in the law how that on the Sabbath days the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? Which I would read, by the way, as but are blameless. But I say unto you that in this place is one greater than the temple. But if ye had known what this meaneth, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, ye would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. And when he was departed thence, he went into their synagogue. And behold, there was a man which had his hand withered. And they asked him, saying, Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath days? That they might accuse him. And he said unto them, What man shall there be among you that shall have one sheep, and if it fall into a pit on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold on it and lift it out? How much then is the man better than a sheep? Wherefore it is lawful to do well on the Sabbath day. Then saith he to the man, Stretch forth thine hand, and he stretched it forth, and it was restored whole, like as the other. Then the Pharisees went out and held a council against him, how they might destroy him. So, in the first six verses of Matthew chapter 12, Jesus does not deny that what he did violated the Sabbath. He admits, yes, this violated the Sabbath. He simply observes that he is greater than the Sabbath. And by that I mean, he said, okay, because they said, you can't eat the corn on the Sabbath day. He said, David did. David went to the temple and ate the showbread. And I'm greater than the temple. So again, Jesus never disrespected the Sabbath day. He never said, this isn't violation. He wasn't going to play that little game of, I can do this but not this, and do all the loopholes and the technicalities. He said, I'm greater than that. In verses 7 and 8, he states emphatically that he is the Lord of the Sabbath. He is the boss of the Sabbath. He claims authority. So in other words, if you said to Jesus, it's not right, it's wrong for you to do that on the Sabbath day, Jesus' response was, I'm the boss of the Sabbath day. It's up to me to decide what's right and wrong on the Sabbath. That's my call. And then in verses 9 through 14, he deliberately provokes the Pharisees by healing a man on the Sabbath day, thereby demonstrating not only that he is greater than that, but he is the master of it. And so, of course, their response is, he's got to go. Now, so let me just review, okay? Let me give you 5 points from Matthew 12 and one from Mark 2 that are developed about the Sabbath day in concerning Jesus. Number one, he is greater than the Sabbath. He is greater than the Sabbath. Number two, he is more interested in mercy than in sacrifice. Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath day? Absolutely. Absolutely, it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath day. Number three, Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath. And number four, it is therefore lawful to do good on the Sabbath day. And then, with reference to this same incident, Matthew doesn't tell us, Mark does, Mark 2:27. The Sabbath was made for us, and we were not made for it. So those are the five critical New Testament concepts about the Sabbath. Jesus is the master. He's still more interested in mercy. It is lawful to do good. It was made for us. We were not made for it. It was made to be a benefit to us. We were not made to be its servants. This is what the Pharisees had done. They had turned man into the slave of the Sabbath day. Although I can't draw the verses out, A, B, C, and D, I would propose to you that the biblical New Testament church embraced that spirit and worshiped God not on the Sabbath day but on Sunday. Now, we can demonstrate that. In other words, my proposition to you is that Peter and Paul ultimately came to understand that it was not the entire point of the New Testament church to turn around and become Pharisaical in its service of the Sabbath day. But that since all of that was about, to, with reference to its practice, was pointing to the arrival of Christ, and he has come, and we are in him, and he is in us, our observation is different. Symbolically, the Sabbath pointed to the original creation, right? 6 days God worked, seventh day God rested. This is the original creation. Sunday points to the recreation, the regeneration, the new birth. And we are, by the way, this is why we can never distance ourselves completely from the Sabbath. Hebrews chapter 4, verses 9 through 11, the preacher says, there remaineth a Sabbath to the people of God. We still don't have the rest of completion, folks. Right? When God rested on the seventh day, there was no more work to do. There was no more creating to do. Why don't we have that? Because the work is not done. We're not done. We're waiting for the final rest. We're not finished. We're still a work in progress. The church practiced worship on Sunday. Turn, if you would, to Acts chapter 20. Acts chapter 20 and verse number 7. And upon the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread, Paul preached unto them, ready to depart on the morrow, and continued his speech until midnight. Now we'll tackle a little bit more of that the next time we come and look at this, because there are some interesting questions to be raised about that. But when did the disciples come together to break bread? And we would understand that, by the way, to be a reference to the Lord's Supper, something that evidently they were doing weekly. And they did that on the first day of the week. I won't have you look at it, but in John chapter 20 and verse number 1, if you were looking at it, a literal translation, and I would, by the way, I would encourage, here's something you can do, seriously, if this is the kind of thing that interests you. You can take any Bible software program, cut and paste those verses, go to Google Translate, put them in English and translate them into the Greek, and you'll get a fairly accurate rendition of what's being said there. Or you can take an Old Testament verse and translate it into Hebrew. I made mention of the fact that these were kind of markers upon the first of the week. Literally, John chapter 20 and verse number 1 reads something like this, on the number 1 of the Sabbath. All right, we have the Sabbath and we have Sabbath plus 1. That's how they count it. 1 Corinthians 16:2. I'm looking at the clock for the sake of time. I won't have you turn to it. Again, we're going to look at that. That's when Paul is talking to the church at Corinth about taking their offering that's going to be sent back to Jerusalem. And he talks about on the first day of the week when they come together. So the New Testament church, while it did not disrespect the Sabbath, it did not throw out the concept of one sacred day in the week. They just understood it to be the first day, resurrection day, not the last day, covenant with God day. So where does this leave us practically? And I'm just going to throw some statements out in the air, and of course, the devil is in the details, as you know. But where do we stand practically? Well, we're bound by what Jesus said about it. He is the master of it. But it was made for us and not us for it. And mercy, which I would understand Jesus to be talking about a reflection of the heart, is way more meaningful than mechanics, which is how I would understand what he was getting at there. Mercy, not sacrifice. He commanded the sacrifices. But, and we'll get into this, but I'm a fan of three services a week, four services if you divide Sunday school. I really am. So I'll give you my standard disclaimer. I'm not looking to undo anything. But let's not deceive ourselves, folks. You're not automatically better off spiritually because you go to those four services. To have them is fabulous. To think that because you're in attendance at them, you've got a grip on something is ludicrous. Anybody can come into the building and go off to a distant planet intellectually, mentally, and emotionally. So we're certainly after something more than just getting people into the building. And again, we'll talk about that. Secondly, we're not allowed to be abusive about the way in which we practice this. Turn, if you would, one last passage, and we've looked at it a lot, but let's look at it again, because I think there's an important point that needs to be made. Romans chapter 14. Because I think this is a very real danger, and I would caution us against it, into thinking that because we are freed, Colossians 2, 9 through 16, from the strict obligation to worship on the Sabbath, that we are free to entirely disregard the Lord's Day as any other day. And I think that would be to misread what Paul is getting at in Romans 14, beginning in verse number 5. One man esteemeth one day above another, another esteemeth every day alike. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. He that regardeth the day regardeth it unto the Lord, and he that regardeth not the day to the Lord, he doth not regard it. He that eateth to the Lord, for he giveth God thanks. And he that eateth not to the Lord, he eateth not and giveth God thanks. I don't think, folks, that any New Testament Christian has the right to view Sunday as equal to every other day secularly. I don't think you do. I don't think I do. I don't think I get to come to Romans 14 and go, Sunday's just like any other day. It can be a vacation day, beach day, picnic day, laid home and watch TV in my bathrobe day, mental health day, because every day is alike. Because what Romans 14 is arguing is not that every day is alike secular, but every day is alike sacred. So Paul's not arguing six secular days and a holy day for one guy. He's arguing every day has to be holy for everybody. So I would argue that a day for corporate worship is critically important. We're always up against the barrier. And I would argue that this is not accidental, but by design. Right? Because you're always going to find somebody who goes, well, if you can't open the New Testament and point out to me that says, thou hast to be in church three times a week, then I don't have to be. And I think you're really missing a critical, important point here. The New Testament is written to Christians who are expected to function like adults, not like children. Adults don't need as many things spelled out for them. They're mature. Small children need a bedtime. My guess is you don't have somebody imposing a bedtime on you, but I bet you set one on yourself because you're mature. So when people argue against all kinds of New Testament practices on the basis that you can't find a chapter and verse, I would just simply say, you're absolutely right and it's a good thing. Here's an opportunity for mature Christianity to honor God. And here's an opportunity for insincere Christianity to honor themselves. So we'll get into what the day looks like. And boy, there's a bunch of stuff pertaining to our conscience there.